Actually, I became the protected child of the war correspondents, and I was very fortunate about that. So by travel, by talking, by listening above all, in the places where I go to, or as it was, East Congo, or wherever the books take me, then I fill up my rucksack, my backpack. And then I like to take everything, all my scraps of paper and my memories, down to Cornwall and sort them out there. So it's engagement, escape, engagement, escape. I think, again, it's very similar to a journalist's life, except nobody checks my story out. I don't have to tell the small truth. I have to be looking for the big truth.
Master spy novelist John le Carré, the pen name for David Cornwell. He recently died at the age of 89. We did that interview in 2010 in London. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Dennis Moynihan. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriano Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is in our final week of fundraising through Gift Guide. Show your support by December 31st by donating at kboo.fm/give. Every new and increased donation will be matched up to $25,000. So donate today. That's kboo.fm/give. You know
I'm
back.
Thank you. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up next is an encore presentation of KBOO News in Depth. Then at 5:30, stick around for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
KBOO Evening News is off this evening, and instead we present to you a look back at some of our favorite News in Depth pieces. Tonight, we will be hearing two author interviews with Ken Jones. First, the book Anti-Racism with author Kenria Rankin.
With Joe Biden's victory in last Tuesday's election, a new administration takes charge in January, and they'll be facing some pretty big challenges. Along with COVID-19, climate change, and the battered economy, the unmasking and encouragement of racism and white supremacy over the past 4 years tops the list. Our in-depth guest today, Kenria Rankin, has been an important voice in that struggle as an author, journalist, editor, and speaker. Kenria co-authored How We Fight White Supremacy, a field guide to Black resistance, published last year. Her new book is Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas, available now from Seattle's Sasquatch Books. Kenria also co-hosts the Turn On podcast, which focuses on literary erotica created by and for Black women and the LGBTQ community. Kenria, thanks for joining us today from your home in Washington, D.C.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Kenria, let's get right to the newest book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas. It's a beautifully designed work. You've called it somewhat of a coffee table book, though a little smaller.
Yeah.
And it features over 100 quotes from anti-racist leaders, past and present. In the introduction, which really struck me, this analogy, a ladder analogy, you use to depict white supremacy, which you define as a political, social, and economic system that thrives on the subjugation of people who have not been let into whiteness. Can you describe that ladder for us?
Sure. So, as you said, you know, I like to use that analogy because I think it really helps people to get an image of in their mind of white what white supremacy is. So what I tell folks is to close your eyes and envision a ladder. It's sturdy, it's stable, it's firmly rooted into the ground. And on the very top rung sits white, cisgender, heterosexual, Christian, wealthy, educated, able-bodied man. And every other person in our society gets slotted in somewhere below him based on the oppression that's been heaped on their shoulders. And those oppressors can include racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, all the isms and the obias that you can think of that push us closer down to the ground. And I like to use this because I think it can really help people understand the ways that the things that are heaped on us determine our place and our value within the society that we're operating in.
You also mentioned that there's a toxic smog, a very effective analogy, that envelops the ladder, and it affects everyone. So those you know, white, Christian, middle-aged, able folks who are at the top of the ladder might think that it doesn't affect them. But you make a strong point that they're still being poisoned by the very same system that's hurting everyone else below those top rungs. How does white supremacy poison even those at the top of the ladder?
Well, I think that, you know, it doesn't take much more than to look at the celebrations that we had in the street over the weekend to see the ways that people have been pushing up against it and were happy to be freed from the ways that it impacts their lives, right? When you have someone who subscribes to white supremacy and who uses it in order to shore up their own power, the policies that they make influence the ways that we live, right? Even folks who are at the closer end of the top of that ladder can still feel negative effects when, you know, policies are not put into place to keep them safe during a pandemic, for instance, right? You know, there are folks who may check all of these boxes except for the fact that they are not wealthy, and they may vote for candidates who have policies that ultimately don't actually serve them, but because they led with their whiteness and because they wanted to prop up this system which has privileged them for so long, it can be easy to look past the ways that it hurts you economically in the long run, because it can be really attractive to see someone who feels the same ways that you do, who centers the issues that seem to be most important to you, even if they're not necessarily digging into the things that ultimately underpin the daily ongoings of your life, like not having stimulus checks that allow people to be able to stay home and stay safe in, you know, difficult times.
What struck me, and I liked a lot, was it's not just selfish and cruel, white supremacy, but it's also self-destructive for even those people at the top. Now, you include this quote from Angela Davis in the book: "In a racist society, it's not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist." And of course, the book is titled Anti-Racism and not Non-Racism. Can you talk about the difference between the two?
Sure. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, that ladder that we're talking about of white supremacy, it's propped up by a few things, and those include, you know, racism and classism and whatnot. And so one thing I like to make clear is that white supremacy doesn't act on its own. It's got all these other things that prop it up, and racism is just one of them. And so being anti-racist is just one of the ways that we can help to battle white supremacy. And being anti-racist simply means being actively working against the system of that privileges racism. So that doesn't mean saying that you're colorblind. It doesn't mean, you know, a lot of the things that people do that kind of dance around the issue. It means that you are taking action each and every day to make sure that you are operating in a way that dismantles that part of the system.
Yeah, and there's this poem in there from Nayira Wahid, "Never trust anyone who says they do not see color. This means to them, you are invisible." And throughout the book, you emphasize the importance of recognizing and accepting our differences, not just race, but a number of things. If somebody is disabled or a different religion, a different sexual orientation, and not overlooking and homogenizing them, which is a tendency in the U.S. And you have another quote from Pastor Michael McBride: "Liberation is where a difference is seen as an asset and not a liability." Why is that a more effective way and probably a necessary way to combat racism rather than just this common practice of saying, "Hey, I don't see color, we're all the same here in the U.S.?
Well, because ultimately, you know, and the quote that you read previously really gets at it. At the point that you say that you don't see color, that you are colorblind, what you're ultimately saying is that you don't see me. And it's impossible for you to dismantle a system that you can't even acknowledge exists. And how can you help people when you can't acknowledge that you can see them? You know, people ask me all the time, you know, what is it that they think that they should do? And I think, you know, I start there. Like, don't call yourself colorblind. You should be working toward being anti-racist. Another thing is, you know, I tell folks not to ask Black and other people of color to do emotional or other labor for them. A lot of, you know, what it means to be anti-racist is to do research and find out information for yourself and to not expect other people to do the work for you, which very often is labor that is placed upon the backs of Black folks. Also, it's important to be courageous and hold yourself and the white people around you to be accountable for the ways that they're holding up the system of white supremacy.
That's actually a lot of good advice, but the book itself is kind of more educational and inspirational than prescriptive. And I have a quote in your previous book, How We Fight White Supremacy. You took a similar tack. And in your introduction to that book, you wrote, "Although this book is not prescriptive, if we had a magic button we could press to end this nightmare, we would have leaned on it long ago." And I used "it" instead of some words.
Yeah. I was wondering what you were going to do there.
I know. Well, instead of the beep, I thought I would just kind of reword just slightly. Mm-hmm. And the book you called it is thoughtful and hopeful and bursting with agency. I would say the same thing about anti-racism. So that's very much by design, not taking that prescriptive approach.
Absolutely. You know, I think this book really functions in a couple of ways. One, I think it's an entry or 101 to the concept of anti-racism that we've been talking about. And then I also think it works really well as a resource. You know, my daughter was recently studying her lines. She's doing this virtual play at school because we're, you know, still doing remote learning. And Cesar Chavez was one of the leads in the play. And she came to me and she asked me a bit about him. And I was really excited that I could pick up the book and flip to the page with his, you know, words and his photo, and then also read the short bio that I wrote about him. And that's really how I hope that it functions for a lot of people. You know, I hope that folks can use it as a resource, but also move beyond that and in reading it, either see themselves on the page as they currently are or see the person that they want to be, and that it helps them find their own ways to be actively anti-racist every single day.
I wish we could speak more. I've got so many questions here. But the last one is, where can listeners find out more about anti-racism, your newest book, and all your work and upcoming events?
Sure. So online, I'm at kenrya.com, which is KENRYA.com. And since my parents are so creative and gave me a name that no one else really has, I'm at Kenrya on all the social media. So on Twitter and on IG, I am there heavy. So I'd love to see you all there.
We've been talking with Kenrya Rankin, author of the new book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas from Seattle Sasquatch Books. And you can find out more about anti-racism, Kenrya's new book, and all her work online at kenria.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
You are listening to a KBOO News in Depth special featuring author interviews from the past year. Next, we hear about Finding Home in the Bitterroots with author DJ Lee.
Our in-depth guest today is DJ Lee, author of the new book, Remote: Finding Home in the Bitterroots, from Oregon State University Press. DJ is a Regents Professor of Literature and Creative Writing at Washington State University, the director of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, and a scholar fellow at the Black Earth Institute. She's published 8 books on literature, history, and ecology. Remote is her first memoir. The book won first place for memoir in the Idaho Writers Guild 2020 competition, and it was featured as one of the most anticipated books of 2020 by the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association. In the words of writer and Idaho native Kim Barnes, Remote is part adventure story, part cautionary tale. DJ Lee's quest weaves through memory and meaning like a broken trail. The ghost she is searching for, her grandmother, her grandfather, her friend lost in the wilderness and never found, appear and disappear in moments of mystery. Always, what she offers is a map that we might follow. More than blood, it's story that binds us, all that we have to make sense of our lives. DJ, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken.
Before we started, I usually start off with a little intro here on how you're doing during the pandemic, but the book is fascinating. There's so much to talk about, so let's get right to it. It starts out in the first few pages as a mystery. A friend of yours goes missing in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, and you join the search to find her. Can you tell us a little bit about your missing friend, Connie Sailor Johnson, who was 76 when she was last seen, and I think you had met her about 13 years earlier?
Yeah, so Connie was a legend back in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, which is a 1.3 million acres, and then it's also attached to the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness to make over 5,000 acres of roadless land. So it's a huge place. Connie was a legend before she went missing. She loved hiking alone. She was also just extremely people-oriented. She was originally a teacher, and teaching was what she did constantly. She just was oriented that way. So she was cooking for a hunting camp up at a place called Big Rock in early October 2018. They went on a little side trip for a few days, and they think that she went for a hike up to the rock, and at that point nobody knows what happened to her. I still don't. It's was just so shocking because she was so beloved by people far and wide across the U.S. People came out of the woodwork to try to search for her, that she, of all people who knew so much about the place, would disappear is still mind-boggling.
Now, the mystery aspect is a big part of the book, of course, but it evolves into much more. A history not just of the Selway Bitterroot area and the Namipu people, also known as the Nez Perce, who are its native inhabitants, and I didn't know this, but going back over 11,000 years. But it's also a family history as well, the book, a meditation on women and wilderness, even a ghost story. And you've said you started out thinking you were just writing a history book because that's your background as a scholar and an academic. And you started writing the book before Connie's disappearance. How did Remote change in about the 15 years you worked on it?
Yeah, well, I had originally started it as a research project when my grandmother died. She and my grandfather had lived back there for 12 years in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And I didn't know anything about the place because my grandfather had died when I was a an infant, so I never knew about it. My grandmother never talked about it, even though I was very close with her. When she died, that she left a box full of all of this information about the wilderness, and that to me was her way of saying, you need to go find out about this place. So along with friends and family and people like Connie, who worked for the Forest Service, archaeologists, artists, I went in many, many times thinking that I actually did do a research project. I started an archive and did 50 oral histories of people who'd lived and worked back there over the years. But at some point, I realized I had done all of this personal writing about it too, and that to tell this story apart from my own personal story and the mystery of my family, which there's still things that I don't know and will never know about my grandfather especially, but also my grandmother, I actually had to learn a different way of writing, which was a surprise to me, because at that point I'd written like 6 academic and scholarly books, and I just thought, oh yes, I can just do this, but I couldn't. So I actually had to go back and get my MFA to learn how to weave narrative and history and meaning together.
I was going to, in the next question, mention your grandparents, so George and Esther Case. And as you said, Esther, your grandmother left you all these incredible documents. And yet you call her in the book the Queen of Concealment. There's a little bit of a paradox there.
Yeah, well, because she had this habit when you asked her things that she didn't want to talk about, like my grandfather, like certain parts of her past, she'd just say, oh, there's nothing to say. Or let's go out to the garden. She had her way of pivoting and diverting. But she did keep a lot of things that then surfaced after she was gone. A lot of relics, some old movies that my grandfather had shot in the 20s and 30s. He had one of the first moving cameras, personal moving cameras, and he shot so much footage back there in the wilderness, mainly of animals. He was obsessed with animals. So she kept all this stuff. It must have had meaning for her, even though during her lifetime she denied that it did.
Now, the book is very much, all these mysteries, these ghosts, and of course the wilderness itself, but it's also has a central theme of mother and daughter relationships. And that's between your mother, Shirley, who accompanies you on several of your backpacking trips into the wilderness, and the one between Shirley and her mother, Esther, who we've talked a little bit about. And that was somewhat of a dysfunctional relationship between Shirley and Esther. And you said growing up, you had a similar relationship, somewhat similar between your mother and you. How did these relationships change over the course of researching and writing the book?
Well, I think that was my main motivation without really realizing it for choosing this topic as my next kind of research topic. I mean, ostensibly, I needed to find out the history of this place because that was what I did as training. But when I look back, I think it was about trying to heal those relationships. And in the book, I do talk somewhat in a few chapters about the rising field of epigenetics, which scientists have now proven that certain traumatic events that happen to us or our ancestors are actually passed down through our DNA. And the country most responsible for doing the kind of healing work of epigenetics is Germany, post-war Germany, not the Jewish people, but the Germans. So it's, you know, dealing with guilt that may not be yours, but it may be your ancestors.
So the guilt in some respects can be inherited.
Yes.
Genetically.
Yeah, guilt and trauma and fear and a lot of things. So I began to see that kind of healing taking place through these different trips into the wilderness, and especially with my mom. She and my father volunteered at one of the remote outposts called Shearer Airstrip for 5 years, and I went back there every year with them. And I feel like those weeks that I spent with them were really healing weeks. And I started, at first I didn't care for the wilderness, because I felt like maybe the trauma that caused the kind of difficulties in the mother-daughter relationships had stemmed from this land, and maybe it did. But I started to realize the land also had this healing effect. So the very thing that caused us to feel shattered was the thing that brought us intimacy. And that happened over many years, and I didn't realize the kind of reversal of that until quite late in the process.
Yeah, the book does get into the spiritual and what some people might call the mystical aspects of the wilderness. In a previous interview, you called the Selway Bitterroots a mythological place, and traditionally, in religious literature, spiritual literature, the wilderness is where people go to have dreams and visions. Did you experience that here? Did that healing take place, in other words?
Yeah, and I have to say that because I'm a scholar, by training, I resisted the mythological and the mystical aspects of the wilderness for quite a while, and I was very hard-nosed about it, and I did not want to romanticize it or read into it. And I know that the Nimiipuu and the Salish used the land for not only for homes, but also for their own spiritual ritual. So I didn't want to like appropriate or tag on to that. But honestly, wilderness has been a spiritual place for Celtic people, for many early peoples, you know. And so eventually the wilderness broke me and was like, damn it, I'm mystical and you have to accept it. So I do feel something nostalgic and I do feel when I'm not there, and then when I'm there, I definitely get this sense of awe and something larger than myself at work that I will never understand and probably not meant to understand.
I love in the book and in some of your past interviews, you make the connection between going into the wilderness as you did and writing a memoir, which you did. So you had that kind of double whammy experience. You said that writing this book has been like going into the wilderness itself. It forces you to face things you'd rather not. You have to open yourself to it and let it do its work. And you used an epigraph, a quote from the writer W.G. Sebald, German, since we're talking about Germans.
Yeah.
Ghosts and writers meet in their concern for the past. Was that just something you picked up on as you were writing, as you were backpacking into the wilderness on your quest here, and also learning this different way to write, which you talked about, rather than straight academic, personal memoir, kind of braided together?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you noticed that epigraph, because W.G. Sebald was probably my biggest influence. I don't know if you've read his books, but he's so, you know, he's amazingly intelligent and gifted, but he does weave large historical events and quirky, you know, he kind of goes for the quirky and the odd moments within these larger historical movements with the personal. Although he doesn't strictly write memoir, but he in this very personal voice, but also traveling through. And so I feel like his sensibility matched up most closely with the journey that I was on. I did get a lot more personal because I was going, you know, because I explored relationships.
And your family relationship,
yeah.
your mother,
yeah.
And grandmother too.
Yeah, right. But he remains my absolute favorite writer still.
We've been talking with DJ Lee, author of the new book, Remote, Finding Home in the Bitterroots from Oregon State University Press. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
This has been a KBOO News in Depth author special. Thanks to Ken Jones, and thank you to everyone who has helped with our volunteer-produced newscast this year. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media critic Margaret Sullivan made a plea to journalists to turn off their fascination with Donald Trump when he leaves office. Acknowledging, as few do, that elite media profited off a monster they helped create, Sullivan asked outlets to just say no to setting up a Mar-a-Lago bureau or entire beats dedicated to what Trump and his family are up to. Quote, and for God's sake, stop writing about his unhinged tweets. Close quote. While we await the day that particular face and voice are no longer at the top of every newscast, it ain't over till it's over. And harms Trump does as a lame duck are harms nonetheless. Public Citizen is keeping an eye on these last-minute maneuvers. We'll hear from the group's executive vice president, Lisa Gilbert. Also on the show, hang on to your hats. Research says cutting super-rich people's taxes doesn't really help middle or lower-income people, but does make rich people richer. If your hat's unmoved, it might be because you remember